Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. We are continuing our series of battles going over David Lynch, famed director, recently passed away. Tonight we've got a good one. Episode 19, Mulholland Drive versus Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me.
The only podcast in the world with the courage to watch 8 David Lynch films in 8 weeks.
And then I want to remind you that this
one another
that it was my idea. I know.
Idea. I just want to remind you that. Welcome,
of all of everyone. The bad decisions I've ever made in my life, this is way, way up there.
Well, you know, it is what it is. We've had fun. I think we've had fun with the David Lynch stuff. So I've enjoyed it because I'm a Lynch fan. So, but you have never been exposed to it, have really, it's been a treat for me watching your interpretations on some of these films.
It's like when you pat my head and go, yeah, Eric, I guess in a way that could make sense if you just don't think about it at all. Yeah,
exactly.
We are having fun. I'm happy to do this with you, of all people.
We've got an excellent one tonight. I will say that it's two of my favorites, especially because I like the show Twin Peaks. So we got Mulholland Drive versus Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. And we've got a guest that is here with us for the first time. We're glad to have him and want to introduce our special guest by kind of showing a little bit of their work here. This is song is The Long Way, and is Don't Panic, and their lead singer is Ed Pellicet, and he's here with us tonight, so let's bring him in. Ted Panic.
Hey,
good to have you.
How you guys doing?
Doing great, man. We're so glad that you could be a part of the show. Because I know that you guys are really busy. We're going to talk about everything you got going on in just a few minutes. But we're just glad you could take the time out and do this. I knew from being a fan of Don't Panic that you were, in fact, I got my Don't Panic t-shirt on. That you had a song about Twin Peaks called Fire Walk With Me. And so when this movie came around in the tournament, I'm like, I got to see if Ted wants to do this. So that's what the idea about having you on came up.
Cool. Yeah, I'm happy to be here. I too like David Lynch and Twin Peaks, obviously. So, you know, it's gonna be cool to talk about it with you guys and see what you think.
Well, we got a quick clip of your song. I'm gonna play that.
Okay.
And just to give Eric an idea of what this song is. Are you familiar with the Fire Walk With Me song?
Why would you ask me that with Ted right here?
So that is Fire Walk With Me by Don't Panic. First time I heard that song, I actually started laughing because being a Twin Peaks fan, I'm like, this is great. I saw the title and first time I heard it, I'm like, oh, this has got everything in it about the show. So tell us how you came up with the idea for that song other than the show.
It's pretty cut and dry there, right? It was during the pandemic we made that album, and we were watching a lot of Twin Peaks. Like, it was like one of those shows that we kind of worked our way through season one, season two, the movie, and then season three had come out during that time frame too. So we were just watching it a lot. And I've always been a fan of, you know, I'm a big like sci-fi guy. I'm a big like X-Files was like my favorite show ever. And and Twin Peaks is like, it's kind of like a soap opera X-Files in a way, where it's like you're mixing like a soap opera with like the X-Files. That's always kind of like when I watch it, that's what I think of. So yeah. I don't know. I liked the premise of the whole thing where it's like, it's about this like TV polished town that's got like an evil underbelly that is like starting to permeate through into everything. And there's like one thing that's kind of like keeping it all contained. And I don't know, I thought it was a cool premise to write a song about. So I just like surface level just wrote it about literally the, like the show. Like I just, instead of like trying to like bring in ideas of it, I just like wrote all the lyrics about the show exactly. But it's the idea is that it has that same vibe as the TV show, where it's got the undertones and all that kind of stuff. But yeah.
Was the watch through during the pandemic the first time you had gone through the Twin Peaks universe, or were you revisiting those first couple of seasons?
So I had seen it, but not in full. Like I never like sat there and watched the show, like, cause that it came out like a little bit before the X-Files. Right. And I think it was like 89, 90. It was like right then, like, right. And I was young, I was 7 or 8. So I was like, I saw it on TV and then I saw it like, I saw a random episode and I knew lots of stuff about it. Honestly, a lot of stuff I knew about it was from other pop culture things referencing it a lot. The Simpsons specifically would talk about Twin Peaks all the time. They always have like little, there's like a scene in the Who Shot Mr. Burns episode where the Chief Wiggum has a dream that like Lisa is there telling him like the clues of to find out who shot Mr. Burns, and it's she's talking backwards, and I was like, what is this? Like, I didn't know what it was referencing, and then I looked into it and found that out. So it's always been around, but like that over the pandemic, we sat down on the couch and we watched all of it straight through. It was the first time I ever was like absorbed everything, like all at one time.
I'm rewatching it right now because we were doing the movie. I knew I wasn't going to get through all 30 episodes of the first two seasons before we got to the movie, but it made me want to revisit it. And it is addicting once you start it. It is one of those shows that you want to see the next episode. Now I was around 17,
25
when the show came out, and it was for me, remembering being a teenager, it was one of the few type of event shows. Like the people that I hung out with, we were nerds. We had to get together and everybody had notebooks. I mean, this was before Lost, before a lot of these shows where people would get together and kind of have watch parties. And a group of friends and I, it was such a phenomenon when it came out. Nothing was like it, this episodic type thing. And the thing you touched on with the soap opera, it's really funny. My wife has never seen it. She's not a big Lynch fan. So she'll hang for about 15 minutes and then it's too bizarre for her. But she's like telling me the other day when she heard the music and the sounds from the other room, she thought I was watching a soap opera.
Yeah.
Because he gives that tone.
Yeah, the music for sure.
What I thought about the song that's great is the chorus, the damn fine cup of coffee. It's a great piece of cherry pie. I mean, that's what the agent Cooper does. I mean, that's all he does. He's so impressed with the town. The small town atmosphere. It's so enthusiastic.
I think it's endearing. I think it's supposed to be representative of being very appreciative of like the small things in life. And he's like, we can get into it when we're talking about the movie, but because he's not in it a lot. Yeah. So his character is supposed to be us in the show. And he's finding all of like the small joys throughout the town. And like that's, again, like I said, the lyrics are supposed to be like representative of what's happening in the show. So it's supposed to be like, find out all the small joys in life and really revel in them kind of thing.
Yeah. And I think that's what's great about the song. Before we get into the movie, I do want to go through some of the things you got going on. So while we got you on here, give a chance for people to find out what you got going on in order. You guys are busy.
Yeah, we're staying busy. So the first thing we got coming, I got on the screen, how fancy. So the first the first thing we're going to be doing is we're doing a short little tour with the guys in Wheatus, down to Atlanta. So just 4 shows. This is easy, I can just read it right off the screen. Just said we met them last year on tour with the Bowling for Soup guys, and they invited us to come do more shows with them, and we're like, hell yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, I would kill for that opportunity. I wish it was near me. Because I would definitely love to see that tour. That'd be awesome. And then you're going to England.
Yeah.
Into the UK with the Dolly Rots. That's a great bunch of shows right there. So all the UK fans.
Yeah. I love the UK. It's one of my favorite places to tour. Yeah, we're going with the Dolly Rots, who are some of our really, really good friends. And this guy, Danny Gruff, really excited. It's about 10 days or so. And we go every year now. So we're doing the small club circuit, playing those small rooms and cranking it out. And yeah, doing our thing.
UK fans are so great. We lived there for several years. And that's actually when we got into Bowling for Soup. And just they really love rock. They really love their rock. They love pop punk. So it's a great atmosphere.
For sure.
You got the Pop Punk's Not Dead Fest coming up June 6th and 7th.
Yeah, coming down to you guys. Well, Eric, I mean, his area, right?
Eric, yeah.
We're going to be down there with Jarrett and the Van Full of Nuns, who are, I think, from Dallas as well, and Mest. And then we're actually going to do, we haven't announced them yet, but we're going to do two more shows in Texas with Mest. We're doing June 5th and June 6th. We're going to play Houston and then Dallas, or Fort Worth, technically. I don't know if I'm allowed to call it Dallas. But
I mean, people in Fort Worth would mind if you called it Dallas.
Yeah.
Over here in Dallas, we don't care. You call it all Dallas.
That's okay. And then the 7th will be in that Buda town at this festival. So that's going to be really fun.
That's going to be great.
Yeah.
And then this is where you're going to see me July 18th, because you're in my backyard. I'm just over here in Dayton, about an hour away. So I saw you at Rumba. It was 2 years ago, I believe.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. I think.
So we were out there.
We were with Mest, I think,
you were with Mest.
Okay, yeah.
Keep Flying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Keep Flying, I think. Great show. I had a great time. So definitely going to do that again. So you'll see us then.
All right, yeah. Chicago, Columbus, there. Detroit. Yeah, little weekend awesome. Run there.
And then finally, you got the Spill Canvas.
Yeah, Iowa.
20 years. Yeah.
I see Vinny excited about Iowa. Yeah, I've never played in Iowa. I've never played in Fargo. I've never played in Sioux Falls, so I'm excited to get out to those Great Plains states and see how great they are. Hopefully great.
Well, like I said, you guys are extremely busy, so I'm glad we could catch you before you hit the road, because I know you guys stay busy, and I guess you're working on another album, so yeah.
It's literally, if I was doing a podcast, usually I would have my headset and my mic, but it's all set up back there because I've been writing and demoing songs. So I don't want to, no offense, I just don't want to break it all down to do this, to have to set it all back up. So I was just like, hopefully this is good enough for you guys.
Yeah, no worries. Oh, I did want to mention that you do have a album that you did of covers. You're under your volume 2.
Yes, Undercover 2. Yes. And we did.
I loved Time After Time with Kelly from the Dolly Rots. It's an amazing track.
Thank you. Yeah. Every song on volume 2 was a number 1 on one of the birthdays of the members of the band. So it's all songs from the 80s. We did Jump from Van Halen, and we had Michael Starr from Steel Panther singing guest vocals on that. And then Time After Time with Kelly. And then we also did Jesse's Girl and Died in Your Arms. Oh, really cool.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was able to stream that. Thank goodness it's on one of my services, because I have Amazon Music. So we appreciate that. And it's a great album. So for everybody out there, make sure that if you haven't already got those, go out and get them.
Thank you.
So now, with the business part out of the way, we bring you what we brought you in here for. This is what we do in the podcast. We set up a bracket. It's appropriate because it's March Madness right now. And we kind of make the category films go head to head. And we've been pitting the David Lynch films. We picked 8 of his, what we thought were his best. We left Dune out only because it's a mess unless you watch like the 4-hour version.
He also hates it, and it's not really his movie. He didn't write it.
Right.
He didn't create it. That was like a sci-fi novel. And he took it. He wound up doing that and turning down doing Return of the Jedi, actually. And he was supposed to do Return of the Jedi. And then he Lucas told him the story. He's like, this sucks. I don't want to do this stupid movie. I'll do Dune. And then that didn't plan out that great either. He's not like a big.
I don't know if I could imagine David Lynch. Yeah. Surprisingly, with The Elephant Man is really great, but I could imagine David Lynch doing Return of the Jedi.
I wouldn't mind seeing him get his hands on some Star Wars stuff. You know, maybe not one of the original trilogy, but one of these, shithole Disney Plus series that they crank out.
You can't do worse. Unfortunately, honestly, he's dead now, and he could probably still do better than a lot of the Disney Plus stuff.
Than this last one for sure that they just gave up on.
Yeah, yeah.
Midway through.
But, oh, you talk about the Acolyte. Yeah, that.
Yeah.
Woo, yeah.
I mean, I gave up on it way before they did, and they gave up on it early. So I just was like, I can't spend any more time on this. Andor 2, we've got to look forward to. And
I'm
that,
very excited.
I'll
about
be
Andor.
Excited yeah. about.
But, me too. You know,
some of these were pretty terrible.
Yeah, like the first
season. Speaking of pretty terrible,
what?
Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, huh?
Now, don't start. All right, so in our final four, we've got the Elephant Man and Lost Highway, who just edged out Blue Velvet. Tonight is we're dealing with, yes, Mulholland Drive, the 3 seed, going up against the 6 seed, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. Now, that's why we have Ted here. We talked about Ted loving the show. I love the show. And it does help. And I tried to tell you before you watch the movie, do some like wiki searches. Learn okay, a let's, little bit about the lore.
This is a little bit of revisionist history, because 2 weeks ago we finished the show, and then you said, oh, the next two that we're doing are Mulholland Drive and Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. If you haven't already, it might make sense to watch all 30 episodes of Twin Peaks. Like, I fucking yep. have the time, and you're being ridiculous. So yes, the compromise is that I would like look up some things about the universe, which I also did not do. So I went into it just about as blind as I always do.
Oh,
and but I will say, you guys were talking about when this first came out, Ted, you being 7 or so, Greg, you being like 30, that because you're significantly older than I am.
Significantly, yes.
I was about 12 at this time, and I was, as listeners and Greg, you know, I was raised in a very conservative, sheltered household, very, like, it was pretty tough, right. Especially to consume a lot of the media that my friends were consuming. You know, my parents found a Def Leppard album in our house and just about had a heart attack, you know, stuff like that. But even I recall the Who Killed Laura Palmer phenomenon around that time, having really extremely limited access to the cultural zeitgeist of the time. And it was so pervasive, you know, that even some, you know, dummy like me had heard about it. So I was excited to get into it. I mean, you know, again, without having a lot of the framework that you guys had, having already seen the original series.
A big part of it, I mean, it's hard to really get across, but the Who Killed Laura Palmer, as much as people cared, it didn't matter. That wasn't what, like, that was never actually supposed to even have a resolution when they made the show. So they did season one, and then they started season two, and then the I think it was NBC basically told Lynch, like, you have to tell us who the killer is, like. And they forced him to, and he left the show. Like, after, like, you find the killer out in the second season by, like, episode, like, 3. And then the show just, like, gets really terrible. Like, really bad, because they don't know what to do. They don't have any direction until he comes back at the very last episode and, like, kind of, like, steers the show in the right direction again. And
he definitely seems like the kind that would leave that up to you out in the...
It wasn't necessary. It wasn't even what the show is about, but everyone who watched it made it what the show is about. Like, the show is about using her death as, like, a vehicle to introduce you to the characters, to the town, and then, like, and then essentially, like, everyone's like, but we want to know who killed her. And it's like, no, it doesn't matter who killed her. Like, this is something about something else. But then eventually, once he had to, like, kind of, like, give that away, he was, like, really super just disheartened and was just like, I don't care about the show anymore, and he left. And then the show, like, you're better for not having watched the second half of season two of Twin Peaks. Like, as good as season one is, and as good as the first half of season two is, I can't watch it. I think it's there's so many bad things in it. It gets better again when Lynch comes back and closes it all out. But so the main reason that he made this movie was to, because he loved the character Laura so much, and he basically said, like, I wanted to give her a voice because she's dead the entire show,
right?
like she's in flashbacks, or she's in, like, you know, in what you probably don't really, having just seen just the movie, like in the lodge, she's in like that purgatory world, but she's not ever actually present in reality. So he wanted to like kind of give you like a feeling for what was going on. And I know, even though I was young, people hated this movie when it came out. It was very disliked. Yeah. Because Twin Peaks ends on like, the series ends on like a cliffhanger, essentially, where you the main character, who's Dale Cooper, gets like possessed by evil. And then they're like, all right, that's it. See you guys later. And then like they kind of like wrap it up. Everyone's like, what the hell? What's going to happen? And then they announced they're going to put a movie out. And the movie's a prequel that has nothing to do with any of that stuff. Everyone's like, what the fuck? Fuck this movie. Like, you know, they're pissed off. So it's kind of, it's weird to just start with the movie if you weren't like invested in the show. Because there's all these things that happen where you're like, oh, what the hell is this? Like, why do I care about some ring? Who's this little midget guy? Like, there's like so many weird things to it.
I mean, I think that is true. And again, the benefit of having seen and understanding, like I said, the framework or just this atmosphere, this kind of universe that they'd built already, certainly had to be helpful. But one thing that Greg and I have talked about a couple of times is, for the average viewer, and I am either that or somewhat below average, there's kind of this desire to want answers to every question that kind of pops up within your own mind.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And David Lynch is kind of notorious for not satisfying that in us, you know, as a hoi polloi.
Right.
And so I had to go into a lot of these kind of allowing myself not to know everything about everything, and either hoping that by the end of it, I've kind of pieced it together, even if I didn't get it along the way. Or that I think we often say to ourselves, well, what did the creator, author, whoever mean by this? And the possibility exists that he didn't mean anything specific, and that the meaning was always going to be up to the person consuming it. So Greg and I having had those discussions helped in Lost Highway. It helped in, what was the one last week that lost to Elephant Man, Greg?
That was Wild at Heart.
Okay. It helped in Wild at Heart. Yes. And I honestly think it helped in Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. The enjoyment that you guys got, or the entertainment that you guys got out of it, is probably different than what I did. But I must say that kind of going into it pretty blind, it wasn't unenjoyable. And it didn't feel to me like I had missed out on, well, if I had only seen 30 episodes of Twin Peaks, all of this would make sense. I mean, I doubted that, you know, within myself. So I honestly rather enjoyed, as much as one can enjoy a story about,
it's pretty dark,
drug addicted, you know, teenage prostitute incest victim. The understatement of the year, as I was laying in bed watching this and my partner looked up and said, she's having a really tough time. Yeah, I would say that she is having a pretty tough time.
Yeah. It's really dark. Like, of David Lynch's movies, this is probably one of the darkest, I think, content wise. And then like you said, like the last, after the first 30 minutes are over and you kind of get through the intro of the other agents and like they're doing an investigation about a murder, and then you just like follow her, you follow Laura Palmer around, and you like you kind of see like her life and what's happening to her, and you're like, there's, when you watch the show Twin Peaks, it's got all this like different moods, bubbly, weird, fun. There's like weird, like parody stuff, and like I said, soap opera-y, overacting sometimes. Like this is like a horror movie almost, like the last, like, you know, the second half of it, and there is no real bubbly fun aspect to this this movie. I mean, you watch it and you're just like, oh my God, like it's a really shitty, if you're not being confused by like their extra plot stuff, then you're just watching some girl like completely destroy herself and then get destroyed by the people that she's supposed to trust. And you're like, all right, this is fun. Like, you know, like the ending has like a positive note to it, but yeah, it's not great. Not a great life.
You brought up an interesting point about when the movie came out, it wasn't well received. And I was one of the ones that was like, we had heard, you know, you heard going into the movies, it was going to be a prequel. So you were, but you were still expecting with Lynch some sort of time jump to show what happened to Agent Cooper in the Black Lodge. And we don't get it.
Or like what Eric said, answers too. There's no real answers in this movie.
You do get Cooper in the lodge at the end with Laura. So you're kind of like, okay, is this forward? Are we forward in time? But I will say this, it's become kind of beloved after the fact by the fans, because now that we have three seasons and you had Lynch come back in 2017 to do the third season and you kind of get a little bit of resolution, it fits into, and especially they have like another movie, The Missing Pieces, that has like all the deleted scenes. And there's a guy out there that actually, yes, exactly. Like the David Bowie stuff is in, that explains a lot of what happened with him. And it's in the deleted scenes. And there's a guy that went out and made a cut of both movies and put them in order so that you can watch one complete 3-hour Twin Peaks Firewalk with me. And it is, if you haven't seen it, it is exceptional. But yeah, like the David Bowie thing is he was jumping around in time.
Yeah.
And he was lost, stuck out of time. But if you don't know that, it's such a small part of the film. You don't know what it has to do, but it has to kind of do with what happened to Chris Isaac with the time jump where he goes in.
Yeah.
Ted kind of hit on it because I just kind of put that part of the story aside. It you know, at some point it became more about the story of Laura Palmer and less about some of this metaphysical or, you know, magical stuff. And if I didn't get it,
right,
I mean, I guess that's just some small sliver of my life that, you know, I just don't get, and I just move on with the parts that I did get, right?
So they are connected very much. However, mm-hmm. a lot of it is either obscurely connected or much bigger picture connected, if that makes any sense. Like, like David Bowie as Philip Jeffries, his time also in this world is non-linear, and it's like kind of once like the lodges that you want to call it, like that red room basically where the little guy's dancing and everything's backwards, like those exist outside of time. I guess like the best way to describe it is if you're a Marvel fan, like the quantum realm, like where Ant-Man goes, like there is no time where you're there. So you could enter and exit kind of whenever. It doesn't necessarily have to be a wherever. So how you said, like at the end, you see Agent Cooper in the room with Laura, like kind of with her as she sees the angel and she's like happy because it's finally kind of over. That is Agent Cooper from the end of the second season. Even though she had died, technically he is still like outside of that room is still living the show Twin Peaks or starting it. When she dies, he's already there waiting for her from the future to like, as like a comfort kind of thing.
Yeah. There's
another example of like the weird time thing is like, if you remember, Heather Graham is like in, Laura's bed and she's like, tell, write in your journal that Agent Cooper is in the lodge with you. She's coming from the future of season two. Like she gets killed in that lodge and she's kind of like seeing her from the future to give her a warning. It's like a weird cyclical thing. Cause then she writes it in her journal and then they find the journal and they're like, what is she talking about? So it's kind of like a Terminator thing where it's like this happening created a series of events that led to it happening. If that makes sense.
Yeah, and then she had the sports almanac, right?
Exactly.
Took it back and like was putting bets on football games. I don't know, but yeah, it ended up pretty weird.
the one thing that the opening stanza does with Chris Isaak and Kiefer Sutherland, which I really enjoyed as a standalone piece, because in the show they reference Teresa Banks's murder, and they feel like it's connected and that this serial killer is going to strike again. So they kind of set it up in the show. So when you see it, it's like, oh, we haven't seen this. And so they introducing, you know, Desmond in their journey to figure out Teresa Banks' stuff. The opening, what I really like is the scene with David Lynch with the hearing aid. It's just hilarious as Gordon, because you get Gordon in the show. He's always on like an intercom, kind of like Charlie from Charlie's Angels, and he's always yelling. So to see that live is great. And then what I really liked was the interpretive dance by Lil in the airplane hangar, because it makes sense when Chris Isaac's trying to explain the dance. It's kind of Lynchian in its own essence, where Chris Isaak is kind of saying there are things here in this movie that are going to be representative of other things. So this is what you need to look out for. And then he mentions the blue rose on her dress and says, I can't tell you about that.
Yeah. So what Lynch is doing here, and I've seen some stuff about this, where basically, like, he's the director of the film. He's also the FBI director. So he's like, his part in the movie is like literal. He is the director also in the movie. And he's kind of telling them what they're going to go do. That's all the weird hand. Like, he's talking to Chris Isaak and just being like, this is your mission, essentially. You're going to go do this and this. And then that girl dancing and like the blue rose, like, that's, again, it's all kind of part of the show. But, and then Kiefer Sutherland's like kind of like a new agent who doesn't really know what all this stuff is. And, and honestly, what it really kicks off at, I wanted to mention quick, is the TV getting smashed, which is a very, that's a very just like, no, like on the nose, this is not going to be the TV show. Like, that's the message, I think, right at the beginning. Like, bam, like, don't expect this, because this is not what you're going to get. So, yeah, like, I mean, you're kicking off in like alternate universe Twin Peaks. I feel like, was it Deer Park or something like that? I forget the name of the town. Where there's like the shitty diner with, there's the mean cops. It's like everything is the real world. Twin Peaks is not really the real world. It's a television fantasy of what, like a 50s, like everyone's happy, everyone's helpful. But there's something creeping up that's going to change that. And the show starts outside of that world. And it starts off in this, like, what real life is like. The cops are shitheads. The people at the diner are mean, it's dirty, they're investigating a murder. And then when Chris Isaak disappears after he finds the ring at the trailer park, they're kind of like how I said earlier, Cooper is us. He's the detective, you're watching the show, and you're learning about things as he learns about things. Chris Isaak is supposed to be us at the start. He vanishes because we don't need him anymore, and they're going to bring in Cooper, we're stepping into this like kind of fantasy world now. So that's kind of like, it's like representative of like, all right, we're done with him. You watched, you know what I mean? Like you learned about the murders and like, this is happening in real life, but now we're going to go into this like television fantasy and kind of experience it that way now.
Man, I'm glad you invited Ted on, because he makes a lot of sense, Greg. You don't ever make any sense. You try to explain this stuff to me, and it's like, no, that still doesn't make any sense. Ted makes sense. You don't make sense.
Everything,
well, Ted can.
Everything's very. Everything's very. No, it's a great show, but I can't be here all the time. Sorry. Everything is very representative of something. Sorry. Everything is. Everyone, everything is always not exactly that thing. Once you're in Twin Peaks, I feel like.
Yeah. Do we treat the third season of Twin Peaks as an equal to the first two? Does it feel like a tack on?
No.
At the end? I mean, what say you two?
It's got a very similar tone to the movie than it does the TV shows. There's a lot less of that silliness. Because I mean, not to get too crazy with it, but the whole premise is that Laura Palmer, in my vision, is like, represents goodness. And the town she lives in is pure. And there's like an evil thing that's seeping in and kind of infecting the town. And that's representative of the character Bob. Bob is like essentially is evil, like the concept of evil. And he's taken over her dad because her dad, I mean, you see the shit he does. Like and I don't want to say too much bad stuff, but we all know what her dad's doing to her since she was a kid, yep. Which she says. And he's a murderer. Like he kills the girl who they're investigating in the beginning. Yep. It's hard to decide if it's like he does that stuff, so then Bob gets control of him because Bob is evil, or if Bob is like evil that's, I would say, like inhabiting him, that's making him do bad things. It could be both. It could be either. Maybe it's like he has some bad tendencies and then evil gets into him and makes him act on those bad tendencies. Let's say that, right? So Laura represents good. And essentially what has to happen is she takes on, not she's Jesus, but she takes on all evil and lets it kill her so that the town can stay good. And then again, I think the town's representative of television and when she dies, you know, it's the town stays good for a while. Eventually evil re-escapes. And then in the third season of Twin Peaks becomes this like kind of like the town in the beginning of this movie. Not that the characters are bad, but everything's kind of soured. Everything's kind of dark. Everyone's not as happy. It's not as silly. So the third show kind of like Twin Peaks, when you're watching it, seems more just like your neighborhood. Like it's like Breaking Bad. Like all the tones are dark. Like everything's different. So I would say that the show, the third season, is good because it kind of shows you. It's almost like Lynch was saying, okay, you want more? Like, well, this is what you did to it. Like how you said earlier, people want to know everything about everything. Like people who like Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, or like all these things, they like look up all the books and they want to see more movies and more shows. And they can't just let the cool thing from Star Wars be cool. Like I didn't need to know who Darth Vader's grandma was. Like I don't care. Like, but some people do. And I think the third season was him going like, this is what you do to things you love when you do that, when you dig too much and it makes it sour, it makes it not what you wanted. So like that's why the third season's good, because it's almost like people expected it to be the TV show it was and they didn't get what they wanted because they made it not be good. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. So Greg, what stood out to you as you watched this, you know, kind of you had the foundation, you're seing it as a true prequel, right? So the events that start with a body floating down the river in Twin Peaks are the events that end this one.
Right.
You know, what stood out to you as you watched it?
Well, Ted hit on it a little bit, and it's a true Lynch, you know, kind of theme or method, is that deconstruction of Americana. He does it in Blue Velvet. It's clearly obvious. It's that small town thing. He does it in Lost Highway, and it's the illusion of what is reality and what is fantasy. And that's what makes a lot of his films conceptually so interesting, is because it bridges the gap. And sometimes you don't know which is which. Even Ted's song, Firewalk With Me, talks about, is it real or is it a dream? Because he bases a lot of his themes on a dreamlike type of state. So when you watch Firewalk With Me, and I appreciate it more now than I did when it came out, because again, that's not what we expected, what we wanted. He gave us what we needed, kind of thing. And when I see it now, even though, like I said, it's really dark, you get to understand the darkness in the town, that's being held in the town, a lot better by watching Laura go through everything she goes through. When you watch the show for the first time, nobody really knew how bad things or crazy things were in Twin Peaks when it starts. Cause like Ted said, it's very friendly and happy. And then they slowly start to peel away, and you've got affairs, you've got murder plots, you've got people burning down a mill. There's so much darkness that is going on and under this happy facade. And this film really takes the darkness and what it's about and kind of puts it right front and center. The final scene in the train car is nightmarish.
Yeah.
It's nightmarish. And so it is exactly what you expect underneath all of that pretty facade, that that fantasy of a small town Americana.
I mean, yeah. Something you touched on seems to be a pretty common theme with our other movie tonight, Mulholland Drive, is that it probably wasn't as well received initially and then kind of gained a more positive reputation over time. Do you think, and this for either of you who had seen it, do you think it's a bunch of disappointed Twin Peaks fans that kind of kept it, you know, a 5 out of 10, and then as we re-examine it over time, it becomes, at least on IMDb, a 7.5 out of 10 movie? I mean, do you think it was specifically that disappointment that led to the low ratings? What do you think
led to that? Well, for starters, like I said, when they showed the killer in the show, I think, and this is, I don't have to think, this is the case, like the viewership dropped off massively on the show. Everyone got what they wanted, like episode 3. You know what I mean? Everyone's like, well, that's like if like Lost in season 2, they're just like, here's everything, here's why, here's the island, this is, and explain everything. How many people would keep watching Lost, you know?
And here's 40 more episodes.
Yeah, and here's 40, and then we're going to do a movie to tell you about before. Who's going to watch that?
Yeah.
So
I think, we build the plane.
Yeah, so everyone who really loved the show probably liked the movie just because they got more of what they wanted. But I think, A, like, you're not appealing to a lot of people who didn't watch the TV show. And then the layman who just kind of watched the TV show because it was, like, the thing to watch. Remember, you guys know, there's no internet there. There's no like chat rooms and YouTube breakdowns of everything about, like, people were just kind of, they watched it, they talked about it with their friends, and then that was kind of it. And then, you know, they made references about it on TV. So I think that a reason that people have come around on that and a lot of Lynch's work in general is because of the internet. People get to like really build up the ideas, get to really dissect it, and like, you could watch and be like, I don't know what the hell I just watched. That was stupid. But if you watch a podcast of two guys kind of being like, well, this is supposed to mean this, and this, I think this is, and you go, oh, okay. You have to appreciate that, all the weird stuff a little bit more. Because I was the same way. I watched it, and I was just like, what the hell am I watching? Like, this is so weird. And then...
You mentioned something that and maybe there's not an answer to this, but... Since it's a prequel that came out after the first two seasons, again, for those of you listening, we're talking about Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me. But I wonder how limiting it was from a marketing or just kind of viewership standpoint to call it Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, as opposed to if you just released a movie and it was called Fire Walk With Me, you know, because I could see people being put off by, well, I never even watched that show. Why would I watch this movie?
Yeah, that's very true.
And it, kind of putting it in this box of it's just a companion piece, and you know, since I'm not familiar with the main body of work, who gives a shit?
I'd feel comfortable saying I could almost bet that Lynch would not have wanted it to be called Twin Peaks Fire. If he would have called it just Fire Walk With Me, and then the studio execs are like, no, you got to brand it. We got to get, you know, you got to get the fan. You know, it's like anything else. If you named the Avengers Endgame movie just Endgame and they put Avengers on it, people were like, what's this movie? You know, like, if there was obviously like commercials, but you're trying to say like they want that brand.
So yeah, I wonder if it did the reverse, you know.
I mean, because studio executives know what they're doing, so of course yeah. So of course they fucked it up somehow, but it probably did do the reverse.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, the thing is it says Twin Peaks, and like we talked about casual fans, people may go see it just because it has that moniker on it, even though they may not even watch the show. And then they leave the show like, what the hell just happened? That's horrible. And so you get this reputation. You know, Lynch has his fans, and that's who he's making the films for.
It's like Tarantino.
So if they don't do well, if they don't do well at the box office, it's usually because the fans didn't like it at the time. But one thing I've found out about Lynch is that give it time, people will absorb it through multiple viewings. And then they're going to end up loving it because they know what they're going to get. It just takes some time for them to analyze it and break it down to really enjoy it. And that's the key about Lynch's work. I love films that are linear, that tell a story, and they're funny and they've got action. But I also like films that make you think. So it you can get a little bit of everything. And in Lynch, what I like about Twin Peaks or anything we've watched of Lynch is I like the character studies. I like the characters he introduces that you don't really see in every other type of film, kind of like Tarantino, these little quirky ones, or the Coen brothers, these interesting subjects that you don't, they're not Hollywood actors. They're just, they're new. They're different. And I think he does that really well with these.
He likes his tropes, and he's got a way. I mean, like, even the two movies you guys are talking about tonight, I actually saw this as a double feature at a drive-in theater last year.
Wow.
It's interesting that this is the two on this episode. But these two and some other of his movies too, a big theme is the duality of a person and like how there's two versions of yourself and you can go one way or another or whatever. The character Leland, her father, like I said, you don't know if he's evil, if the evil just inhabited him and he changes. Because like in the movie, he'll just be like weird and quirky. All of a sudden, he just like turns into another person. Even physically represented in a lot of the scenes as the Bob character. They don't even show him anymore because he's like become right. So much that they're showing that guy instead. And it's kind of the same with Laura. Like you'll see her kind of change on the dime in the movie. She'll all of a sudden just be really nasty to people. Mm-hmm. And you know, so I think, and then obviously in the Mulholland Drive, I mean, they literally change in who they are in that movie into other people. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a big part of the movies as well.
Without a doubt. Now, I know you're really busy. Do you want to stick around to talk about Mulholland Drive? Or
I would love but I cannot. I cannot.
Well, I understand. We were glad that you were here for Fire Walk with me. Really appreciate the time that you spent to talk about it because, hey, you wrote a song.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's great. So thank you so much, Ted. Appreciate you, man.
Hey, guys.
Thank you so much.
It was
much.
Really fun. I really enjoyed talking about the movie. I hope you did like it, Eric. And
I did.
And maybe some of this discussion helped you kind of be like, all right, I kind of get this or that a little bit better. I know Lynch movies are tough, so I struggled with it, but I've been getting better at it. So
yeah, man, I appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Great thank insight, you guys. Ted. And see you on the road in July.
Yeah, see you guys out on the road.
Sounds good.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again. I know. All right. So thanks to Ted from Don't Panic. We're really glad that he could be on here to talk about something that he really appreciates and knows a lot.
Clearly passionate about this. And I mean that in a good way, not in the like weird, you know, knock it the fuck off way. Like the guy, I don't know, just, and I mean, I guess maybe to me it's extra impressive because he's got the ability to kind of take all of that in and then digest it, kind of sort through it and explain it in pretty layman's terms, a pretty complex universe that was created here between the you know, canonical first two seasons, a prequel movie, another season that came after, another companion movie, you know, piece. And to kind of take all of that and the additions and the subtractions and just turn it into really simple math for the rest of us it's a talent, first of all. So, you know, good for him for being able to do that, but to be passionate enough about this subject to use it, you know, and
for sure.
To join us for that. Very cool. Greg, do you want to just briefly, while I go refresh my cup of coffee, do you want to give some contact details or talk about the first time you gave a blowjob? Or
I can do all of those things.
Perfect.
And more. I don't know which to say.
All that and next here on
Box Office Battles.
Yes, Box Office Battles. That's the name of it.
Hey, be sure to have an Irish coffee tonight.
I'm tired. All right, everybody. I'll be right back.
Sounds good. While Eric is going to refresh, I don't have anybody to bring me a cup of coffee. But anyway, while Eric's going to do that, want to mention everybody out there, thank you for tuning in to Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. We want to put out our contact information to you. If you're a friend of the show and you've already subscribed, thank you. But if not, you're watching this on YouTube or you're just passing through and you see 5-10 minutes of it and you like it, go ahead and make sure you subscribe, whether you're watching it on YouTube, Twitch, or Facebook Live. We want to see more people out there. We're getting a lot of engagement these days, but we need more subscribers to keep us going. Also, if you have a suggestion, we have got a new category coming up in May after we finish the David Lynch category and we get to the end of that. It's going to be, and I can reveal it right now, it's going to be guilty pleasures, the top eight guilty pleasures. And Eric is going to provide three. I'm going to provide three. And then we're going to ask the audience to give us two of their most guilty pleasure type movies. And then we're going to put those into a bracket and do that in May. So if you've got an idea for that, or if you've got an idea for a future category, you can email us at boxofficebattles. @gmail.com. And again, our Twitch is Box Office Battle Pod, and our YouTube is at Box Office Battle Podcast. Now, with that being said, we are going to get into our second movie, of the two that are going head to head tonight, and that is Mulholland Drive. And I mentioned before that I wrote a paper on this film. The first time I'd seen it was when it came out, and I was blown away then. So when I had a chance to write about it and research it more, I watched it a second time. And I'm going to say, I'm going to reveal it before we even get to the end, regardless of what Eric thinks. When I watched it the third time, I walked away from it the next day. I was still thinking about it. And I just couldn't love this movie anymore out of all of these we've been watching. It's just a special one to me. It's just... because you know why? I'll tell you why before we get into it.
Okay.
Because this movie makes complete and utter sense to me. There isn't much in this film that I don't get. And with David Lynch, that's a challenge.
Yeah.
That's one of those things that doesn't happen when you're watching Lynch film. Maybe
it's like discovering the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, huh?
Exactly. So when I'm watching this and I know the twist, I know the final act of this film, I am seeing all of these things and picking up on all of these moments. And I'm like, wow, there are clues. If you watch it again, if you ever get a chance to watch it again, Eric, you will see the clues laid out in this film of what is about to come. It is fascinating to watch it a second time with the knowledge of what's going to happen.
I have no doubt that that's true. And I think from what I read that there was a DVD release of this that had David Lynch's like guide to viewing Mulholland Drive. And it was some of the same things you're saying, like, you know, does this character say this? And, you know, just some things for you to consider as you're watching the film. Right. And so I have no doubt that that's true. Obviously you and I will have a different experience with this film. It's my first time seeing it. It's your third or more, and you have undertaken kind of an academic look at this film. I mean, I will tell you this. I stayed pretty true to the North Star on this film until about the last 40 minutes. And this, and that sounds, you know, like I'm making a joke. This movie's fairly long, about two plus hours. So for about an hour and a half, I was following this either pretty well or well enough, given my lack of, you know, just general movie knowledge and David Lynch experience and things like that. And as a person who loves Legally Blonde and finds these movies odd, and was enjoying it. And that's not to say, and I'm not about to pull the rug out from under everything and go, but, and it's not that the last 40 minutes ruined it for me or made me like it or dislike it any more or less. It felt, maybe I'm feeling like you did, it felt kind of straightforward. I felt like I had a pretty firm grasp on the things that were happening, even though there are some things that you might go, that doesn't make any sense. But like, I was there. And Greg, right about the time that the blue key meets the blue cube.
Yep. That's the key. That's
it's the key for people who are smart. For me, it was the key to the movie starts making less sense to me at that point.
So let's divulge. Let's talk about the first half, and then we'll talk about the blue key. And it doesn't necessarily have to be smart. It really, well, the first time I saw it, I like a lot of people, it's similar to like a reverse Lost Highway, where you get this idealized version in the first half, and then you get the darker half. Whereas Lost Highway, you have kind of the darker half, and then an idealized version in the second half of the main character. This one, it does a reverse, but it what David Lynch does is he takes care to, like, even from the opening stand up with the jitterbug contest and then showing Betty, you know, being basking in the glow, it is all about her fantasy of living this perfect life. Betty, who in real life is Diane Selwyn, came to Hollywood with a dream to be an actress from Canada. And in the real world, things don't work out as well. Mm-hmm. But in the first half of the film, what it does is it takes this concept of LA and this concept of Hollywood, and it fills a delusion that she has. You have the femme fatale in Rita, who gets an attempt on her life, ends up getting amnesia, ends up needing assistance. And Betty is there like the hero to take her under her wing. Everything is romanticized. Everything. And it's kind of one of the things I think people follow the first half so easy is everything is very Hollywood. It's very scripted and plays like something you've already seen before. And it's done intentionally. The fact that she has these old people, the fact that they're smiling over exuberantly as they leave the airport, a lot of it just has this, it's too good to be true. And as we follow Betty through the story, you get those concepts. And when you see the other people that come in and out of the story when Betty's not even around, that's still Betty crafting the story.
Yes.
Because as you go on, you see those people again in their real roles in life instead of the delusion that Betty had. Like Coco, when we meet her, she's the nice, you know, landlady, but then we find out later she's the director's mother, mom. Justin, yeah, mom, and you see that going on. So anyway, very simply, the movie is roughly a little under 2 hours of fantasy and a good story at that. I think the hitman stuff is interesting. I think the mafia stuff is interesting. But what it's about, what it boils down to, is the fact that Diane was in love with Rita, whose real name is Camille, and Rita fucked her over so bad that it was a complete and utter gut punch in her life. And she crafted this delusion while sitting in her apartment, masturbating.
Yeah.
To
cope.
Right. Yeah. To cope with how her loss. So those scenes that you get, you know, prior to that is all of this. Like, she, how many people go to audition for an acting role and they, you know, get the job on the first audition? It's so perfect.
Oh, sure.
Everybody falls in love with her.
Yes, the standing applause in the audition room, and
that's what happens to everybody.
Yeah.
So it has so many of those concepts where everything is easy for Betty, but then there's danger, because there's got to be, when you're telling a good story, there's got to be adventure. So it's kind of funny, because growing up when I was a teenager, and you have these fantasies of what life would be like if you were a star. Or, you know, everybody daydreams about being a star quarterback or being this. And that's all the first hour and 50 minutes is Diane, a.k.a. Betty, completely delusional and trying some way to bring Camille back into her life by inventing Rita. And the fact that she names herself Rita after Rita Hayworth is not, it's completely intentional. It's a throwback to the old 50s cinema. Mm-hmm. So you, when she sees the poster of Rita Hayworth on the wall and Camille, her having amnesia, she comes up with that name, Betty. It could be anybody. It could be Betty Grable. Could be anybody. But it's that typical Hollywood film type name. So it fits perfectly in that.
Can you help me understand?
Yes.
What the diner scene into the alley, into the odd, you know,
in the beginning of the film.
Yes. Yes. Because I had a really hard, and that does show back up later in the film, but I couldn't quite put my finger on what does it mean to the rest of this.
Right.
So can you help me? Can you TED me here and, you know, guide me into some understanding?
Yes. Yes. As a matter of fact, I can. And again, it connects with the lifeblood of Hollywood, which is the diner. It's where a lot of people meet and businesses are formed, deals are formed, people are cast in films. And Winkie's, it's clearly purposefully looks like Denny's. And that's just kind of the thing, because there's Denny's on Sunset Boulevard that everybody goes to. And this was actually a Denny's that they filmed it at. They just changed it to Winkie's. And this guy has this dream of the most darkest evil that you could ever imagine, and his friend makes him go out and look at it. Now, when it happens in the film, you're like, what the hell was that? You know, you see this, he says it's a man. To me, when you see it, it's a woman, and it's just complete and utter filth and darkness. And then it's so bad.
Yeah, I could have done without the blackface, but
yeah. So now you have to put a pin in that and go through the rest of the film. And when you get to the culmination of Rita and Betty's relationship, when they sleep together, everything is going wonderfully until that moment. And Rita starts saying Silencio in her sleep, and they go to the Club Silencio. So a lot of people have a problem with the Club Silencio. But the Club Silencio tells you exactly what it is when they go there.
No hay banda.
What's that?
No hay banda.
Yes. Yeah. Nothing is real. Everything is recorded. Nothing is live. So they've already gone through so much together, and then the thing is telling them. Now, I do want to say one thing real quick about the Club Silencio that a lot of people don't pick up on. That is as far as a Lynchian Twin Peaks fan, this movie's supposedly connected to Twin Peaks in a way. When they come into the Club Silencio for the first time, Laura Palmer is sitting in the audience with Harriet, her friend.
No shit.
Pulaski from the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Cheryl Lee and the girl from Twin Peaks, her friend, plays the friend that also gets attacked, and she ends up wandering the train tracks. So they're in, and so a lot of people believe that the Club Silencio is like the Black Lodge, or it's like a gateway to the Black Lodge. So it is this dream world where Rita and Betty go. Rita has colored her hair after they found the body of Diane, who they think is just a friend of Rita's who's been killed. They don't realize that it's Diane herself. And they go to the club, and they have the key that they found with the bag of money. And then the singers comes out and starts singing Crying in Spanish by Roy Orbison, but you clearly know what the song is. And it's gut-wrenching because the song, the lyrics say, I was all right for a while. I could smile for a while, but then I saw you last night. You held his hand so tight as you stopped to say hello. And though you wished me well, you couldn't tell that I'd been crying over you. And that's what Betty Diane is going through, because she's been kicked in the crotch by her lover, Camille, the love of her life. The song hits them both. It really is. It's Betty. If you see that when they find Diane's body, there's a blurring instance. That's when the lines of reality start to get blurred. Yeah. And Betty is Camille, and Camille is Betty. She's one entity at this point. And when she finds the blue box and realizes that the key that they have at the apartment. That's what it could open. They find it in her purse. It's Betty having to bring the fantasy to an end, that it's completely over, and she has to deal with that. And then when she opens the box, or when Rita does, she disappears, because the blue key signifies the end of Camille. And we know this why, because later on, when we see Diane, now everything is dark. So you get the key, you get the box, and then you get an empty room. And then when we next see Diane, she is in filth and squalor. She is not doing very well.
And the neighbor comes over and asks for her shit. And yeah. Okay.
So then we get into this whole thing where you get the flashback of what Camille did to Diane and why Diane, it was so despicable. I mean, she was really treating her like garbage, to the point where it made Diane, you know, angry, you know, enough to hire a hitman to put her away. You know, it was the kissing the other girl, getting engaged to the director that she lost the part to. It's very cruel what people do. And that's the kind of thing, is that Lynch goes from this perfect world to this complete and other cruel world. And when she meets the hitman and says, you know, he's like, "You sure you want to do this? I've never wanted anything more in my life." And so we see where the blue key comes in, because he presents the key to her and says, "When I'm done and the job is done, the blue key, I'll leave in a certain place." It's a symbol of she's dead. She's no longer with me. So you get all that, right? So what a lot of people see at the end of the film, when we go back to the alleyway and it cuts in and you see the hag, whatever you will, there's a lot of theories on this. One of the ones that I've read that I think is exceptional, I think it's two things. I think that Diane either killed herself in the apartment, or that's Diane. Diane is, Hollywood has chewed her up and spit her out, because she's holding the box and she drops it.
And I mean, you mean like physically, this is physically actually Diane, not a representation of
it could
Diane be, as a person. Okay.
It could be where Diane has gone, and she could be a personification of evil and guilt. So, and then I've read another theory which coincides with that, where the hag in the back of the diner represents the underbelly of Hollywood, the evil that is Hollywood. And that box, that all the stuff that she has, represents everyone's box, that whatever thing that we do that brings evil upon ourselves or causes other people pain. So when she drops the box, the couple come out of the bag, if you will, the old couple. The old couple represents Betty / Diane's grandparents, and how she was going to make them proud going to Hollywood. So they show up at her apartment, and it's a torment. It's just the guilt of, I've let everybody down. I've killed the only person I loved. I can't make it in this town. This town has eaten me up. It's ruined me. And I can't face my family. I can't face my friends. She goes into hysterics as they torment her. And eventually she ends up ending it, and in a very dramatic scene, which I thought this was just ominous. And it's just
The whole room fills with smoke, and it's a really powerful scene and a really powerful. I mean, maybe it's not imagery because it doesn't represent something else, but that was just a really interesting way to conceptualize a scene like that, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really happy to be on the show with you, because we're friends and because we get along and we, you know, chit chat outside the show and all of those things. But I'm especially happy on nights like tonight, where I kind of came into this thinking that of these two films that I hadn't seen before, that I really kind of prefer preferred Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me because it felt to me like the invocation of a mystical element. As confusing as Twin Peaks can be,
right,
invoking that was well represented with Bob being evil. Now, again, like Ted said, does he cause evil or is he just a representation of evil that already exists? You know, that could be debated. And then there's the yin to that yang with Mike, who is always representing good. And I think Fire Walk With Me probably was easier for me to get through because that's really straightforward. That makes sense to our, well, to our Judeo-Christian, you know, sense of right and wrong, you know, that these things are very black and white, and the movie kind of did that. Mm-hmm. So I kind of came in thinking of that, but listening to you talk about Mulholland Drive and that it's less, it's really less about any type of mysticism or mystical element as much as it is kind of an allegory for all of the things that Hollywood is and isn't and what that can do to a person on top of losing a lover who is also wrapped up in all that Hollywood is and all that Hollywood isn't. You know, it really kind of, you know, like a dryer when you see the towel on top fall onto the towel on the bottom and then the towel on the bottom moves to the top and they just kind of constantly are in movement and fall. And that's how I feel now looking back on Mulholland Drive. I really appreciate you taking the time to kind of lay that out. And I knew you would, I knew you could, because this is, well, it's interesting. Yeah. And it's always refreshing to hear from someone who's really passionate about some specific movie. I didn't particularly enjoy Citizen Kane when we watched it, but I did enjoy listening to you talk about Citizen Kane because that's really meaningful to you. And I can tell that this one is too.
Yeah, it is. You know, like I said, the more I watch it, the more I fall in love with it. I do have one clip from it that it kind of illustrates what I was talking about. Knowing everything that we know, and there's a lot of times this happens in the film where things are said that illustrate that we are living in a fantasy. So this is a scene where Rita is telling Betty where she was or where she was going when she had her accident, and it kind of it just is a quick scene where they talk about what Mulholland Drive is.
I wonder where you were going. Mulholland Drive. Mulholland Drive. That's where I was going. Mulholland Drive. Maybe that's where the accident was. There must be a police report we could call. No, we could call anonymously from a payphone just to see if there was an accident. Come on, it'll be just like in the movies. We'll pretend to be someone else. I want to walk around anyway. I'm in Hollywood and I haven't even seen any of it. Come on, Rita, do you feel up to it?
I mean, right there. And when I watch it now and things like that are said, it's like Lynch is throwing those. You don't pick up on it the first time.
Yeah.
And Lynch is throwing that thing up. It'll be just like the movie. We'll pretend to be someone else.
It's interesting to make a movie, and it had to be purposefully, that almost not you'd be better if you watched it again, but like it requires you to watch it again.
Almost, yes.
You know? And so, because it's like looking at a 3D, you know, comic book or whatever, and there's the red part and there's the blue part. And if you only look at one or the other, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And that's the brilliance of this type of filmmaking, is that maybe the first time you watch it, you're only seeing the red, and he's designed it so you're only seeing exactly half of it. And when you watch the movie through a second time, you're kind of starting to put together the other half. I don't know if that necessarily makes sense. It does to me, but that's not saying a lot. But what an interesting way to do it.
Yeah, what is fascinating to me when on rewatching it now, I get to enjoy the stuff in the beginning, the Justin Theroux walking in on his wife with Billy Ray Cyrus, which it's a throwaway scene, but it's very funny. The fact that she kicks him out of his own house, then when the mafia comes back there to and beats the crap out of her, it's fulfilling. But then you get that connection later on when he tells the story.
Yeah.
At the table. And so you know that Diane has put this in her fantasy because of that. So now when I watch the movie, I'm seeing it through Diane's eyes only. Every little facet of the mafia telling him, this is the girl. That's one of my favorite lines. This is the girl. This is the girl. The guy, the scene with the espresso, the guy is constantly saying, this is the girl. And then it the light bulb moment when Diane slides the picture of Camille over to the hitman and says, this is the girl. I get goosebumps. I'm like,
yeah.
And there's so much about it that really captured my attention, especially this time around. The crying sequence where there's no music and it's just the singing, and knowing what the lyrics are and knowing what Diane is feeling, and then they start to cry. I was like, man, this third time through, I was like, it's a gut punch. And then it was the same thing. It was like, it overwhelms the singer to the point where she collapses. But like they said, this is all a recording. This is none of this is live. This is a recording. So when they carry the singer off and the vocal track is still going, I find it just one of the more beautiful things in the film. It blows me away every time I watch it. And this one, it was like, took it up even higher. I like it more and more. So Mike Florida had a really nice comment. He said, your review and analysis really made my night. I keep questioning my interpretation of the parts of the film, but you made a lot of it much clearer. You know, I don't watch a ton of movies like this. I'm not an art house kind of guy. I'm not a Fellini type of guy, but I was a Coen Brothers guy, a Wes Anderson guy. And so I can, I kind of dig into these films, you know, because I like those type of films and they're challenging. I'm not going to deny that. I've seen movies today, new movies. Like there was a movie called I Saw the TV Glow. It is very self-interpretive, if you will. People will tell you what it means to them, that it's an allegory for homosexuality or trans, and it's supposed to be a horror movie, but it's not really that scary. For me, I watched it and I went, okay, I could probably, if I wanted to put the time and effort, I could figure it out. But I didn't feel like putting in the time and effort. So I just, when it went off, I was like, okay, well, that one's done. Then I met up with my youngest child, and they were saying about, oh, I just saw this movie. Oh, so great. So great. What was it? I saw the TV Glow. And I was like, I'm the type of person that if you love something, I won't shit all over it. So mine was like, what did you think of it? I was like, yeah, I watched it. It probably just wasn't for me, but I can see why you would love it. And I appreciate the fact that you love it so much. And we talked about, and they were explaining to me the facets of everything with, and I was like, okay, well, that makes a little bit more sense. And
sure,
maybe I'll give it another try. But I don't really watch a lot of these, but this one particularly, like I said at the beginning, one of the reasons I love it so much is that every Lynch film is fun, but it's also a struggle. It's a challenge. You have to pick it apart. And this one, I feel like I've got it. It's like, wow, I know exactly what's going on, and I really enjoy it.
And maybe then it's revisionist history on my part, because then as I sit here and go, okay, well, I found it challenging, and I have heard people say that it's challenging, but having a resource like you where I watched it and then, you know, within days, I'm sitting here talking to you about it. You know, there's probably not a reverse of that I could guide you through, but if there were, it would be really comforting. And it feels like then maybe it wasn't all that challenging all along. You know, it kind of is that type of, you know, like a blanket for a kid who just it's security. Yeah. and maybe things were never as scary or never as big or never were as bad as I thought they were. Because now I think back on it and just go, okay, well, yeah, there were parts that I didn't quite understand, right. But it didn't take away from my enjoyment of the film. And it didn't keep me from understanding, in general, what is trying to be communicated in this film. And you and I had already talked about how maybe there are certain instances where he's not trying to communicate anything. It's up to you.
Right.
But in this one, he was. And I felt like I knew that. I felt like I got that. And then to have you fill in the missing pieces, you know, that's just really has made it even more enjoyable. Like I said, I came in thinking Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, even if I didn't like it more, I felt like it worked a little better for me. Yeah.
That's understandable. It's so weird that you say that when you haven't seen the show.
Right.
I'm not going to deny it. I love that movie as well. These are two of my favorite on the list. And it's because, like with Fire Walk With Me, I've watched it a few times as well. And because of the connection to the show, there's a lot of stuff in the movie where there's characters from the show that you get just a brief glimpse of that. For the person who's never watched the show, it means nothing. But for a fan of the show, goes, oh, there's James. Oh, there's Donna. And it's just, you know, brief moments. Donna's in it a little bit more than others. The log lady you get for a second. But she's a fixture on the show. And same thing with Cooper. You only get Cooper for a short while. But all that being said, the movie itself, especially with the deleted scenes added back in, is a great case study of what Lynch does to mess with your mind. It's what made him do what he did in Hollywood. It's why he got an honorary Oscar, even though I believe he was nominated for Mulholland Drive. The more I watched, the more I feel like he should have won. But he did get an honorary Oscar before his passing, and he had one of the best lines ever. If you ever see the Oscar speech, he looks at the Oscar, and in true Lynchian fashion, he goes, "You have a very interesting face, sir." Exactly what you expect David Lynch to say. So like I said, David Lynch is not my favorite director, but he has made some movies that I would like to watch and pick apart and enjoy. And I think some of that, like when you watch Mulholland Drive and you're not in that frame of mind and you're not in that, oh, I'm gonna watch everything and see what I can figure out, it makes a difference. Cause like when I saw the TV Glow, one of the reasons I didn't get into it was because it started off being weird and I wasn't in that, like, oh, I really need to watch this.
Yeah.
Mindset. And that can really mess up. So there's sometimes when there's a film like that, like I know I'm going to watch it, like any A24 horror, like Hereditary or Midsommar or X, I'm like, okay, I'm going to need to shut off distractions, turn the lights out a little bit and watch it. And so, and I may not get it on the first time, you know, of these. With this one, it was like, yeah, when I watched it, I liked it. Then I decided to write a paper about it. And I did a lot of research into it and filled in the missing pieces for me. And then this third time I had reread my essay, which by the way, was total shit. I don't know how I got a passing grade on that. I was garbage. But yeah, so I read the essay and then watched it again. I went, yeah, no, this is a great film. So, all right. Well, that being said, we've kind of discussed both films and we can get out of here by naming a potential winner or a potential tie. I will start off because I think it's clear what my favorite is. I love both of these films very much. But just like I have a favorite child, I have a favorite between the two. And just for the record, I'm not going to name what my favorite child is, but they know the other.
Sure. Two, yeah.
You know, but
it's
doesn't.
Obvious.
It's obvious. They know. But anyway, Mulholland Drive is my vote for this, this round.
Yeah. Mulholland Drive is my vote as well.
Oh, very nice.
I
it's like a gift for me.
It really is. But I think that's the value of sitting down with someone and really, I mean, don't need to make this a bigger thing than it needs to be, but it is easy in life and as opinionated as we are as people and as binary as everything seems to get really entrenched in a point of view. And it didn't take any more than an hour and 28 minutes to kind of to shed some additional color and additional light on what it is that I saw and to take in a viewpoint that's not just mine and then go, okay, well, now I've taken it all in and this is what I feel about it. And so that's, you know, it's kind of on one hand, we can say people are spineless because they flip flop or they, but I think there's value to listening to other viewpoints and deciding that you were wrong about something. I don't know that I was wrong. I still do think Fire Walk With Me was a little bit easier upon its watching one and watching the other.
Right.
Had we not discussed them, my vote would have been for Fire Walk With Me because I got through it. The path was a little more straight and narrow, a little bit.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But the meandering through Mulholland Drive was worth it in hindsight. Yeah. So it's Mulholland Drive for me.
If anything, it's just for when the hitman shoots through the wall.
That was that's pretty funny.
There's a lot of humor in Mulholland Drive, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
That carries it and it does, like, that first half is gripping. So yeah, I'm glad that like I said, I've done this before too, where we've had these movies and then when we start discussing them, I come in thinking I'm going to vote one way, and then as we start discussing them, it's same thing with like Lost Highway. When we started that one, I was like, yeah, and Ted even mentioned it. Wow, you've had Blue Velvet. He preferred Blue Velvet, and I did before we started to discuss it. And then I realized how similar Lost Highway is to Mulholland Drive and just the Lynch universe. There are a lot. If you go out on Reddit, if you go out on the internet and just Google, you'll find theories that connect Twin Peaks, Mulholland Drive, Lost Highway into one. They say that the mystery man of Lost Highway connects to the people in the Black Lodge and that he's one of those that is causing the problems, and that the shed in Lost Highway is another gateway into the Black Lodge, which makes sense. So it is interesting. So we've got one set left to cover of David Lynch films. And this one is going to be, I think it's going to be a lot of fun for us because one is a straight story and it's the name of the movie, The Straight Story. And it is the straightest Lynch film you're ever going to see. And I kid you not, it is a Walt Disney film that David Lynch directs. And I kid you not, David Lynch directs The Straight Story. It's a very enjoyable film, a really, really enjoyable film. And then a pure David Lynch film, a lot of surrealism, a lot of allegory, a lot of bizarre, weird things happening to weird people. And it's the classic that is much beloved by Lynch fans, Eraserhead. So The Straight Story is our third seed and Eraserhead is the sixth seed. So that's going to come up on Tuesday, the 1st of April, when we finish the last of our first round battles. What do you think about this going into?
Well, I can't wait to discuss these with you. I mean, you know, I enjoy the format of the show because I get a chance to see movies I haven't seen. I get a chance to process them. We get a chance to discuss them. And you know, the occasional fart and dick joke, but there's nights like tonight where it all kind of comes together. So yeah, I'll look forward to it. I mean, going into it, one of them certainly seems more my type and, you know, we'll see if I can continue. And listen, I'm proud of myself to continue to kind of overcome my naivety.
Right.
In my inexperience with movies like this and to be able to kind of consume them and digest them So I'll be looking forward to another opportunity to do that.
And I'm looking forward to discussing with you. I think you'll find Eraserhead. I think you'll find it interesting. I definitely think you'll find it interesting. And I don't think you'll find it difficult. I just think it is bizarre, like we've been watching. And it may find it fascinate you. We'll have to see. So with that being said, we're going to head out. Did you have something you wanted to say to that, Eric?
Maybe the first episode where I didn't go off on some fucking bullshit thing in one of these goddamn fucking movies, Greg. It's a miracle. Well,
it was great. Thanks to Ted Felicetti from Don't Panic. We really appreciate him being a guest in the studio and explaining Twin Peaks Fire Walk with me to Eric. And I got to explain Mulholland Drive, and I think he enjoyed both. And our winner tonight is Mulholland Drive. If anybody out there wants to email us on a future category, you can do so at boxofficebattles@gmail.com, or just send us a message. What we're doing great, what we're doing bad, whatever. But make sure if you're watching on YouTube, Twitch, or Facebook Live that you give us a follow. Same thing with Amazon Music, Spotify, iHeartRadio, all the podcast providers out there. Make sure you subscribe so you get each and every episode. All right, with that being said, you'll see us again on April 1st for our next round. Anything you got left, Eric?
Until April 1st, you guys remember, be excellent to each other. We'll see you then.
Have a great night, guys.